San Francisco Bay Area. It's time for Live from the Bay with Joey. Here's Joey.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Live from the Bay with Joey. Have you ever wondered if your family was Jewish or noticed some different or unexplained or secretive customs or secretive Jewish practices while your family still practiced Catholicism or some other form of Christianity? Was your family originally from Latin America and then they settled in Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, or Texas, or even certain parts of Europe? Tonight, we may have some interesting information for you in helping discover your Jewish past. Also, keep tuned into future shows where we will actually be talking about DNA tests that you can take and, together with tonight's information, give you a more educated understanding and helpful unveiling of your heritage. Stay tuned for an exciting show tonight. We have a group of exciting experts on this very topic of crypto-Judaism. The crypto-Jews we're hearing about today are descendants of those Sephardic Jews of Spain and Portugal who continue to observe customs and rituals of Judaism in secret, although having converted to Catholicism in the 15th century because of persecution and violence. Many also converted to avoid the exile decreed by the Spanish and Portuguese kings, which would have forced them, as practicing Jews, to leave their countries and settle elsewhere. Although practicing Catholics, however, these new Christians remaining in Spain were subject to persecution by the Inquisition and the local population. Many left for other parts in Western Europe, like the Netherlands or Great Britain or the Ottoman Empire, where they could return to Judaism. Others found their way to Spain's and Portugal's colonies in the New World, where, with the Inquisition establishing themselves, they needed to continue hiding Jewish practice. Today, many of their descendants in the U.S. and in Latin American countries are realizing that some customs are still practiced by their families, most of whom are Christian, indicates that their ancestors could have been Sephardic Jews. In some cases, there are families that continue observing Jewish rituals in secret through five centuries to the present. Our panelists today have a lively interest in this as people with this very same heritage or as scholars studying the subject. Today, they'll be sharing what they know with us. They are members of the Society for Crypto-Judaic Studies, an academic and cultural organization affiliated with the University of Colorado in Colorado Springs and its Sephardic and Crypto-Jewish Study Program. They'll tell you of their experiences in research and genealogical studies about the subject and their own family histories and describe some of the pathways taken by those who discover this heritage in their families. So we are ready for a wonderful and lively conversation and educational experience for us this very day. Joining me first will be Dolores Sloan. She is the president of the Society for Crypto-Judaic Studies, author of The Sephardic Jews of Spain and Portugal. Again, she's an accomplished speaker and author on the subject, and she will be sharing with us our very first topic, the historical orientation to crypto-Judaism. So, Dolores, are you there with us?
Hi there, Joey. I certainly am.
How are you this evening?
I'm just great. Just good. Great. And I loved your introduction. It kind of made it easier for me.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for being an intricate part of that introduction, may I add.
Yes. Now, there's one thing. I'm no longer the president. I'm the immediate past president of the society. Roger Martinez is the president.
Okay. So I guess the first part of this, you're going to be talking to us and educating us on the historical orientation to crypto Judaism.
Yes. Would you like
okay,
to
it's
start?
All yours.
Okay. Well, you made it easy, as I said, because you gave a very good outline. So I'll try and give some of the details that make it come alive. And I begin with 1492, the year when the Jews had been living in Spain for more than 1,500 years. They had been there from the time when the Second Temple was still standing in Jerusalem. And in 1492, they had already lived under several ruling cultures, first the Visigoths, who made slaves of those who did not convert to Christianity. That was right after the fall of the Roman Empire. Then they lived under the Muslims, and the Muslims treated them very well, recognizing them as children of Abraham. And under the Muslims, they actually had a golden age of achievement. Well, in 1492, which is the date we started with, they were living in Christian Spain and Portugal, the rulers of whom had conquered the Muslims and driven them out. And there, they were the property of the crown. Leaders among the Sephardic Jews had helped the Spanish and Portuguese Christian monarchs defeat the Muslims, yet the gratitude that was shown by King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella was to issue a decree that any Jew who hadn't converted to Catholicism had to leave the land by August 3rd of that year. Well, in Spain, thousands of Jews had already converted through the century before because of persecution, and many more converted at this time to avoid leaving. Well, in neighboring Portugal, King Manuel ordered them expelled in 1497. That's 5 years later. And then he had those who were unable to leave, which was most of them, he had them baptized Catholic, so he could say that there were no practicing Jews in Portugal. You know, there were three ways that Jews responded to this. Some really tried to observe their new religion. They felt that since this was the situation, they'd make the best of it. And others who were never very religious anyway felt, well, I don't like this, but there's nothing I can do about it, so I'll do what I can to look like I'm Christian. And then there were those who really had a love of the Jewish religion and its practice and continued to practice Judaism in secret. Well, the Inquisition began at the end of the 15th century, and it was looking for heresy. It was looking for signs of converts who were still practicing what they called the dead law of Moses. And, you know, even though you were a new Christian, your life wasn't really much fun or even very safe because you never knew when you could be arrested. So many new Christians, those who could, left Spain and Portugal for other regions, and you mentioned some of them. And, of course, I'm going to specialize in the New World. Eventually, the Inquisition followed into the Spanish and Portuguese colonies in the New World. So Sephardic Jews who had fled there thinking they were safe still had to continue practicing whatever they could remember of their ancestral religion. They had to do it in secret. You know, I've spoken a lot. Do you want to ask me any questions or should I just continue?
Well, so my only question that comes through my mind is during this whole period of time that, you know, because we're talking that the Jews had been in Spain for a while since, you know, since they had come from Israel, that they had been there for a while, and now this happened. But weren't some of, now maybe I'm wrong here, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I had heard through somebody that maybe some of the kings and queens might have had some Jewish heritage. Is that true?
Yeah, well, it is said that Ferdinand had an ancestor who was Jewish. It was a woman who had been a lover of one of his ancestors who was Jewish. Mm-hmm. And so there was supposed to be Jewish blood in his family. I don't know about, I don't think Isabella had that, because she was almost directly descended from the Visigoths. She even
Right.
And I don't know about King Manuel, but Portugal, but I doubt it. But we do know that Ferdinand had at least one Jewish ancestor.
And the reason that you said, that's interesting that you mentioned about her having Visigoth ancestry, because that was my understanding. Sometimes these kings and queens of these very countries, such as the Queen of Spain now, is actually from Greece, you know, but also of Austrian and all this other type of heritage. These people were not necessarily Spaniards by ethnicity. They came from other types of lines, right? And then they were, you know, they were now the king and queen of this empire of Iberia, the Iberian Peninsula. But they were not necessarily of Spanish heritage or Spanish ancestry, per se. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And, you know, though, you could say that everyone except for the indigenous people that may have been in Spain,
the Iberians,
way back, after the defeat of the Roman, or the fall of the Roman Empire, most of the tribes and groups left there had come from other areas. So they were all, in a way, immigrants, you might say.
Right, exactly.
I think were Germanic people.
Mm-hmm. So what I find quite interesting is that here you have the Jews and you have the Arabs or the Muslims that had been so much an intricate part of this land, and now they were being forced out by some people that might have been foreigners themselves, or they were from other parts of Europe. And it seemed like they, you know, it's puzzling and it's sad. But we're going to move forward. So thank you for that information. And is there anything else that you wanted to add to this?
Yes, I do. I'll make it really fast because I don't want to take away from the time of the other speakers.
Right, exactly.
But actually, 5 centuries forward today, many of the descendants of these people living in the American Southwest, in Rhode Island, in Massachusetts, in Florida, they're living as Roman Catholics or Protestants, and they're discovering that some of the practices that they do that they thought were just family customs are actually Sephardic Jewish customs or rituals. And so many of them are beginning to look into their ancestry and their genealogy, and the rest of the speakers tonight, at least 3 of them, will tell you about their own personal experiences.
Well, that's wonderful. Okay. Well, I appreciate it. Thank you, Dolores, for joining me now, and I know you're going to stay with us here. So, again, thank you for your contribution to this show. And moving forward here, folks, I want to introduce you now to a friend of ours, too. Dolores is a friend of ours from former shows, Dolores Sloan, that you just heard from. And now we're going to hear from Rachel Amado-Bortnick. So let me tell you a little bit about her. She was born in Turkey, is a Sephardic Jew herself. Her native tongue was Ladino. She's an accomplished speaker on the topic and runs an internet-based social interaction and educational segment called La Vino Comunità. And so without further ado, Rachel will be speaking to us tonight on the manifestation in the Ottoman Empire, past and present. Hi, Rachel. How are you this evening?
Fine, thank you. I'm happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for being with us. So it's all yours. You're free to speak, and so you're going to be talking about the manifestation in the Ottoman Empire, that of the past and the present. Is that correct?
Well, yes. Of course, as you mentioned, I was born in Turkey, and people, even Jewish people, sometimes ask me, what is a Jew doing in Turkey? Well, the fact is that when the Jews who refused to convert to Catholicism had to leave Spain in 1492, they had to go somewhere, and the only place really that was open to them, well, some of them went to Portugal, that's another story, but most of the people who did not convert to Catholicism ended up in the then Ottoman Empire. And that is my ancestry. In other words, I said until maybe 20 years ago that my ancestors never converted to Catholicism. But it isn't really that clear, because people continued to come to the Ottoman Empire throughout the 16th and 17th centuries and even the 18th centuries, where, let me go back and say that we refer to the Jews who had converted as conversos, in other words, converts. And so these conversos that had stayed, like Dolly mentioned, that had stayed in Spain were really persecuted by the Inquisition, and so they started to find ways of leaving. So eventually they went to Portugal. From Portugal, when they could, they went to Holland. And also, a lot of them ended up maybe in Italy, and eventually they ended up in the Ottoman Empire. So a lot of former conversos, we don't know exact numbers, and I'll tell you the reason in a minute, but a lot of former conversos ended up in the Ottoman Empire, in cities like Salonika, which is today's Thessaloniki in Greece, and in Istanbul, which was at the time Constantinople, and in the city where I was born, which is Izmir now, used to be Smyrna, and other Virgin Islands everywhere. Hmm. But so these people, when they arrived, they formed a dilemma for the existing Jews who had never converted before. They continued practicing. Mm-hmm. And the dilemma was, especially for the rabbis, how do you integrate these people who never learned firsthand Judaism into the Jewish community? And what should the relationships be? So we have a lot of rabbinic, what's called responsa, that is questions and answers, from one community to another, and the rabbis discussing it among themselves, and so on. So in my case, if I may bring a personal thing here.
Sure.
As you mentioned, my maiden name is Amado, and we always knew that we had come from this, or my father's family had come from the city of Bayonne in France. It's right on the border between Spain and France, over the Pyrenees, so to speak. And it turns out that Bayonne was a place where former conversos had come and formed a new community. So I'm sure that in my own background, from my father's side, we have conversos. But the very big difference that I find between the former conversos who, or the conversos, not former, but conversos who came to the New World, and those who went to areas when they could rejoin the Jewish community or at least practice Judaism openly, is that in the latter, that is where they could practice Judaism openly, they wanted to integrate to the rest of the existing Jewish community. And so their converso background was no longer relevant to them. And so we did not learn or hear about such things. I mean, eventually over the centuries, they were just Jews. It wasn't an issue. We weren't big on genealogy, you know, and making sure which side we came from and so on. Whereas I find that in the New World, especially, and here, they are very conscious of the families, you know, of marrying within other people like them. You know, that was a tradition, like a grandmother would say, don't marry, you only have to marry into certain families. This, of course, was not an issue because you're just, once you're part of the Jewish community, that's irrelevant to us. But here, with the Inquisition, like Dolly mentioned, in the New World, you couldn't be free and just forget about what happened in the past and just be Jewish again. So that's... and I want to mention that there is one of the most illustrious Sephardic ladies in Jewish history is Donna Gracia Nassi, who was a converso from a very wealthy family that had been in Portugal and then ended up anyway in Constantinople, and was a big benefactor for Jewish causes. She was a very fantastic lady, and she's, I think, the most famous former converso in Jewish history. Her name is Dona Gracia Nassi. When she lived in Portugal, she was known as Beatriz de Luna. So that is a fascinating story.
Was she originally from Spain and then went over to Portugal?
Yes, her ancestry, yes. But she was born in Portugal, as I remember.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. So in my city, and in Istanbul also there was, but in my city, in Izmir, there still is a synagogue that was built with her money originally, and it's called La Signora. That's the name of the synagogue. La Signora.
La Signora.
Synagogue. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. So another thing I want to say is, as you mentioned, that in the freedom, once our ancestors, I want to say we, because we Jews tell our history as if we were there, you know, the Passover story. So when we were... in Spain, under Muslim rule, we lived rather well, and there was this convivencia period where Jews even rose high in the ranks of the government and so on. And there was a flowering of Hebrew and literature and philosophy. Maimonides, of course, is from Spain. So after the expulsion, we ended up again among Muslims, those of us that went east to the Ottoman Empire. And at least for the first couple of centuries, we sort of had another continuing convivencia and a flowering of our, actually, the Sephardic culture that we know today was formed post-expulsion in the Ottoman Empire, mostly. Of course, there's also another branch in North Africa, which I know you'll have another show on that later. But the Sephardic culture as we know it today or in the past years, you know, from people like me who are still alive, was formed really in the Ottoman Empire, because when people were still in Spain, each city sort of had their own customs and so on, until it was codified in Edirne or Adrianople by Joseph Caro, who wrote the book called the Shulchan Aruch, which codified Jewish law and that brought all these customs together. It was a continuation of, to me anyway, of the convivencia that we had experienced in Spain.
I have a question for you. You've used this, and I know what you're talking about, but for a listener, when they hear Ottoman Empire, they may not know necessarily what countries really formed that, or what countries, yes, as we know today. Can you go over what countries those would be that would,
yes,
have?
Yes, first let
what
me say
they,
that,
mm-hmm,
that the it was known as the Turkish Empire. But it just so happened that when the Jews were expelled, this empire was growing and taking on more territory.
Mm-hmm.
So we were also very useful to the sultans. This empire extended to Iran in the east and all the way to the gates of Vienna in the west. But mostly the areas that stayed within the empire the longest are the Balkan countries, that is Greece, present day I'm saying,
right.
Greece, Bulgaria, let me say the former Yugoslavia that is now Croatia and Bosnia and so on, all the Mediterranean, Eastern Mediterranean islands, Rhodes, Crete, and so on, and of course modern-day Turkey,
mm-hmm,
and Egypt also,
okay,
and of course the Holy Land. It was under the Turks from 1563 until. 1543, I think, until 1918, the end of the First World War. The sultans would actually send Jewish groups to settle in certain areas where they felt they were needed. But some, even though they were settled somewhere else maybe originally, some of them ended up in Palestine, or the area called Palestine, which is generally known as the Holy Land and present-day Israel and so on. So the Kabbalists settled in the city of Safed, for example. All these countries are really, that I mentioned, were broken up from the Ottoman Empire. And if you really count all of today's countries that were at one time part of the lands of the Ottoman Empire, you come to about 30 or 40 countries.
Mm-hmm. And if I can interject something here, I know that some of those people from like from the Ottoman Empire and their families also did as well go over to the New Spain or to the new colonies in Latin America. Is that correct? Because
yes.
I know some people.
Oh. Uh-huh. Two things.
Yes.
One is the first Jews in North America were Sephardic Jews. The first practicing Jews, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not
mm-hmm.
talking about conversos who came even with Christopher Columbus, but the first practicing Jews who actually formed the Jewish community in North America had come from Holland. From Holland via Brazil. In 1654, they arrived in New Amsterdam.
Uh-huh.
And the congregation that they formed, Sheret Israel, also
mm-hmm.
known as the Spanish Portuguese, still exists in New York City. Now, there were those early immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
But then, like you said, of course, from the Ottoman Empire also, they
mm-hmm.
came, but that didn't happen until the turn of the 20th century, that is from the 19th into the 20th.
Ah, okay.
So the Sephardic Jews, the Ladino-speaking Sephardic Jews, and for those of you, I'm opening a little parenthesis here, for people who don't know what Ladino is, it's also known as Judeo-Spaniol, and that is the basically the medieval Castilian language that we kept and continued speaking. So the Ladino-speaking Sephardic Jews from the Ottoman Empire that came to the Americas came in the very early part of the 20th century. And, of course, there are people like me who came much later.
Right. Right. Well, we're happy that you came here. To the USA from Turkey. We're very happy that you've been a vital part of the shows that we've done, and we're going to be doing another show with you. And I thank you so much for your portion and your part in tonight's show. So, Rachel, before you do leave us, I know that you have Ladino Comunidad. That's still active. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. We have 1,500 members.
Okay. So if anybody's interested in finding more about that, is there a website that you could give them?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for asking. Anybody who's interested in Ladino, even if they don't speak it, if they speak Spanish, they'll catch on to it. It is, if they would just Google Ladino Comunità spelled with a T, instead of a D, as one word, they'll be taken to the website. It's a part of the Google Groups.
Okay, so now is it? I thought at one point the Comunità was spelled with a K, but is it Ladino?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, it is.
Thank you for saying that.
Okay,
absolutely.
Yeah, because
Thank you.
The people start spelling it with a C.
Yeah, right.
So then it's going to be Ladino Comunità.
Yes.
Okay. So let's try again. Ladino Comunità would be spelt on the web at www.ladinocomunita.com. Is that correct?
Well, there is a Google Groups. .com, I think. I don't have the exact thing.
Okay, well, if they Google...
But people can
just
Google Ladino Comunità, it'll come up right away.
Okay, folks, so you know...
One
word spelled Ladino Comunita, and just Google that, and then it'll go to Rachel's group, okay?
Yes.
So, perfect. So, Rachel, thank you for joining us tonight. And we'll look forward to hearing from Rachel on a future program. So we thank Rachel for joining us this evening. And without further ado, joining me all the way from Miami is Jeannie Milgram. She was born in Havana, Cuba, and into a Roman Catholic family of Spanish ancestry. She's currently the president of the Jewish Genealogical Society of Greater Miami, president of, I don't know if I'm saying this right, Tarbat Sefarad from Ocel in Spain. Vice President and incoming President of Society of Crypto-Judaic Studies at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. She is an accomplished writer, and we'll learn more about this, as she's got some wonderful books. So without further ado, all the way from Miami, would you welcome Jeannie Milgram. Hi, Jeannie. How are you?
Hi, Joey. How are you tonight? Thanks for inviting
Good.
Me.
Well,
a little bit later
you.
Here in Miami than it is out there by y'all, but... we'll keep it going.
So as we say in Espanol, buenas noches.
Buenas noches. So
yeah.
I'm really happy to be here today. I know the topic that was given to me to speak about today was the past and present manifestation of crypto jewelry in Spain and Portugal. And I think that historically it's already been covered how crypto jewelry began in Spain and Portugal, basically. At the time of the expulsion, the Jews had to go underground pretending that they were Catholic and secretly continuing to practice Judaism in their own homes and subsequently being hunted down by the Inquisition. When the expulsion took place, a lot of people wonder, so I want to bring it up. A lot of people ask me, how many Jews were there in Spain? How many were there? And the reality is that no one knows. But to be conservative, and the conservative number that is used is that there were 300,000, and that's very conservative, and 100,000 left to places like Rachel mentioned, the Ottoman Empire, and to Italy and other countries. 100,000 stayed and became Catholics and went underground, and perhaps 100,000 over in Portugal and either died or went on an up later into Amsterdam. But the main number of what was going on as far as numbers was about 300,000. So when you're talking about who went underground, we're talking about 200,000. If these numbers are correct, and we're talking 1492. So those numbers, of course, as you come closer to history, will have grown in leaps and bounds, and today would be millions of people, the reality is, with this kind of ancestry. So back to Spain and Portugal at the time, the Jews were pretending to be Catholic, and they were being hunted down for simple things, for wearing a clean shirt on the Sabbath. They were being hunted down for not, if a neighbor saw they didn't eat pork, or they would light a candle on Shabbat on a Friday night. So after a while, in Spain especially, people got very tired of this. It was too much. They were being hunted down. They couldn't just live a normal life. And eventually they just became Catholics, true Catholics. And with it all, as true Catholics, they kept some small customs. And in Portugal, it was a different story. In Portugal, and we're still talking about the past, in Portugal, people had were not allowed to leave. They were made to convert. It was 4 years later, and they had to stay. And when they stayed, they were also hunted down. But for some reason in Portugal, the Jewish spark became stronger and stayed stronger than it did in Spain. In Spain, it died down. So going to fast forward, because I am a descendant of both the Spanish and Portuguese Jews, I have done my own genealogy. I have gone back 22 generations on a direct maternal lineage and found grandmother after grandmother, unbroken, until I found the actual Inquisition records on my maternal lineage. So grandmothers 1 through 15 were from Spain. Grandmothers 16 through 22 were from Portugal. So the
now,
reality is... Yes.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to ask you something really quick. How, if somebody's, you know, listening to this and they're like, oh, that's interesting, and I know you have a book... that's title, is it, we'll get to the title of your book later, but how did you actually go about to be able to trace this all the way back on your maternal side?
Well, in Spain and in Portugal, the Catholic, you go back via the Catholic Church. My family was Catholic. I actually converted to Judaism way before I knew I had these roots. I had a compelling desire to move towards Judaism without knowing anything about my crypto-Jewish descendant roots. So a good 8 to 10 years before I even discovered this lineage, I had already come back as converted from Roman Catholic by myself. My whole family was and is still Catholic today, and I have now been a practicing Jew for over 25 years. So
let me ask let me ask you, I don't mean to keep interrupting, but really interesting.
Okay.
It's interesting to me because this is a whole different segment of what we're used to, because I've done two Sephardic Jewish programs already, and this one is very different. It has a different feel because we're talking about people that were actually Roman Catholic or Christians, that some of them are now coming back. So there's a few things that are on my mind about this, okay? So, and I don't mean to put you on the spot. So if you don't want to talk about it, just say, Joey, I don't want to talk about it, and we won't talk about it. But when you converted and you come from a strong Roman Catholic background, how did they take that?
Well, the conversion, it was very difficult for my family and especially for my mom. My mom is a very classy Cuban socialite, and this was hard. This was hard to say the least. But it was easier than when I found that we were really Jewish all along, because when it had been a personal decision, it was my own personal decision. But when I, let's use the word, slept the family into it, then it was harder, because after I started researching these roots, and by the way, I did start researching these roots after, like I said, I had been a practicing Jew for several years already, and my grandmother died, my maternal grandmother, and she left me some antique jewelry with Jewish artifacts on it. And she and my grandfather were first cousins from this small village in Spain. And I realized that some of the customs that she had taught me as I was growing up were, in fact, Jewish customs. And so it was only then that I started researching my Jewish ancestry. And your question from before, how do you go about it? Well, you have to go about it via the Catholic Church records. So you run this genealogy back in Spain and Portugal like you would run any genealogy, and I would say any genealogy from someone in Scotland or somewhere else. You just run back a regular genealogy, and at the same time you're looking for cultural clues. And, for example, what is a cultural clue? There were many children that would not be taken to the baptismal font, and their baptism papers would say the child was too sick to be taken to the church, and he was baptized at home. So when you start seeing this in all the records, you start to realize that you either come from a family of very sick children or something, or something's going on. So the actual records themselves, when you start getting back into the late 1600s, start to yield a treasure trove of cultural information. So I went back in all the records. I have every single birth, death, baptism, confirmation, marriage record, going all the way back to the mid-1600s, at which point I was able to find the Inquisition records and start piecing, that's when I started piecing together grandmothers 16 to 22. When I reached grandmother number 15, I wrote my first book, which is called My 15 Grandmothers. And that was when I reached that level of finding, and then I continued to go back via Inquisition records. And this is now, people come to me to see how they did this, and I wrote the second book, which is how I found my 15 grandmothers. And that talks about how to do the work genealogically and culturally. So the reality is that I descend directly from these Jews that were hidden for a while and then threw their hands up. And that's the best way that I can say is what happened to those that stayed. They threw their hands up and said, basta, I can't do this anymore, and they became Catholic all the way.
Now, on your paternal side, is it the same, or is that different?
You know, my paternal side, it's interesting because the whole time I was running the roots on my mom, and it took me many years, my dad kept saying to me, you're wasting your time on your mom. You don't have to dig far to find mine. And I've only recently started to do that, and it seems that both the grandmother and the grandfather by my dad, last names are Perez and Medina, which are both a very Jewish, the Perez de Medina family is a very Jewish family from Spain, and that's my dad. So it seems that the lineage is from all four grandparents.
So that's interesting because, well, I'm going to talk to Dolly about this later because you mentioned surnames, and that's something that we're going to have to clarify at some point in this, you know, in this show because, again, there may be names that, well, anyway, we'll talk about that later. But it's interesting. I mean, the whole you mentioned about your grandfather, your grandmother leaving you some jewelry that had some type of Jewish. What did you say, Jewish?
Correct. I have an earring with a Star of David, very antique piece,
and I have
a Hamsa pendant, which is a hand of God, and this is also several hundred years old. I won't say it's 500 years old, but it's several hundred years old. Now, were they pieces? My grandmother never told me she was a Jew. She never told me that the family was Jewish. She never mentioned the thing, but she did teach me some of these customs to check for blood in the eggs or to sweep a room. Are you familiar with the custom of sweeping a room to the center?
Okay, now, that's funny that you said that. So let me explain something to you. My family is from Andalusia, Spain. Now, I know, because my grandparents were born there, I know for a fact that we are, I'm sure we do have some Arabic background, some worship background or whatever. But interesting, you know how I found this out?
How?
Because I was talking to Dolores. And so she says to me, Joey, let me ask you something. And I said, sure. And she said, when your family goes, you know, when they went to sweep the floor, how did they sweep the floor? And when I first heard about this, I'm like, you got to be kidding me. Really? We're going from a conversation of Sephardic Jews. Now we're talking about how we sweep the floor? I mean, come on. So I said to her, I go, I don't know. She said, just trust me. How did they sweep the floor? And I said, we always swept to the center. Always. And she says, let me tell you something. And then she explained it to me. So I'm not going to take your thunder, but that's how I first found out about it.
There was a tradition when the Inquisition came and stripped the mezuzahs off of our doors, and I'll use the collective, our doors, back in our villages in Spain. And at the time, these were dirt floors. These were, you know, my family at least were not from a big city. They were from a hamlet. So I'm assuming the floors were dirt. And the women would always sweep inwards so that they would never desecrate towards the outside where the mezuzah used to be. And it was such an ingrained custom that the women would sweep to the center of the room and pick up the trash there. Now, funny that, you know, that you had that experience with Dolly because my husband has always laughed at this as well and told me that I'm the only crazy one. So last year we were at the conference of the Society of Crypto-Judaic Studies and in comes a group of singers. And he gets up on the microphone Saturday night. It was like our fun night. And the first thing he does is, how many of you sweep to the center of the room? And everybody's raising their hand. And my husband's like falling out of his chair.
Oh, brother.
So it's a very strong custom. And as a matter of fact, in the book on how to find the ancestry, I have a whole chapter of about 40 questions similar to that. How are the beds oriented to the south, to the north? This type of question that would give you these clues. So
wow.
I've
got to read your book.
I just want to mention one more thing, which is Portugal Today. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to keep taking anybody else's time, but Portugal today, the crypto Jews in certain areas of Portugal, towards the center and up in the north, they lived as crypto Jews until very recently in the Bragança area of the north where my family was from. Bragança had a lot of crypto Jewry, and they were there until the 1920s. And in Belmonte, Portugal, and that's the one that's the most well-known, they're still there. I was there this Passover, four or five, you know, recently I was there, and I spent Passover with 40 descendants, and the women are still memorizing the prayers. The women are still the ones that are in charge. It's a matriarchal religious society, and they are still crypto-Jews today. So that is a very interesting phenomenon that is still going on in Portugal.
So they're still help me out here. So do they still practice being Roman Catholics?
They practice this bizarre mixture of Roman Catholic Jewishness, and there's a rabbi and in Belmonte, and I was there, and I spent a couple of weeks with this 40 people, and he wanted me to try to talk to them as one of them. I'm not really one of them, but I come from that background. And I also had a hard time. I had a hard time breaking them from praying. You know, they pray to St. Moses, and they pray to St. Esther. And it's a very long thing that the rabbis are trying to break, because you can't be both.
Yeah, I mean, that's very...
But
yeah,
this is going on in 2014. This is not going on 100 years ago.
Yeah, wow. That is unbelievable. That's incredible. I mean, thank you for sharing that story. I don't want to go back to the broom story, but I want to tell you something. It's funny. Before Rachel ever told me this thing about the broom, I was visiting some cousins. They were friends of mine, actually. Yeah, they weren't cousins, they were friends. And they were sweeping, and they were sweeping out the door.
Ooh.
Okay? Now, it really annoyed me, and it really bothered me, and it just, I don't know, it did something to me. It just, they swept out the front door, they swept out the back door, and I said, why are you doing that? And they said, why are we doing what? And I said, why are you sweeping out the door? And they looked at me and they said, Joey, we always sweep out the door. And I go, you don't just sweep the stuff in the center and then pick up? And they're looking at me like, are you from another planet? I mean, why would you? Yeah. And so then it's just funny how all these things. And then I get the question, you know, from Dolores. Now, Dolores was the one that originally told me this. So now I'm thinking all along, the Arabic people too, or people that were, Moors or anything like that, do they have that same custom as well? You know, I don't know.
That part I don't know.
I have no idea.
I'm very Semitic looking, and so is my family, and I thought that I could have these Moorish roots at one point. Sometimes I look like I belong on top of a camel, but the reality is that it ended up being they were like the convivencia. There was a very close community. But I really don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, I thank you so much for joining us tonight and your interesting story. And I know if people are interested in finding out more about you, they can go to www.jeanniemilgram.com, spelled GEANIEMILGROM.com. They can find out about your book there as well, or your book. So, again, it was a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for joining us, and we hope to hear from you again. Okay, Jeannie? So thank
Great.
You again.
Great. Thanks, Joey. Thank you so much.
Okay, take care. And that was Jeannie Milgram from Miami, Florida, and who's joining me, is going to join me right now. He has been very patient. He has been waiting for an hour. And, you know, that's really a long time to wait. So he's going to be covering the northern New Mexico, southern Colorado manifestation, past and present. And that's really, really interesting because really that's the heart of what we're talking about, a lot of it. And he's got a very interesting background as well. So his name is Arnold Trujillo. He is a Christian and the vice president of the Pacific Union Conference of Seventh-day Adventists. I had an aunt and uncle that were Adventists. He comes from a background of crypto Jews and in his family. And without further ado, we welcome Arnold to the show this evening. And thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Joey. It's a pleasure for me to be able to be on your program this evening. Thank you for the invitation, for the opportunity.
Thank you.
My story is has its roots there in southern Colorado. I was born in the San Luis Valley, which is a large valley, high intermountain valley, about 7,400 feet at the bottom of the valley or so. And my family are all Hispanic family on both sides. My moms are the Quintanas. My dad is the Trujillos. And our family has been there. I've traced my ancestry back to Oñate, and San Juan Oñate settled there in the Española Valley, which is where the Rio Chama and Rio Grande come together north of Santa Fe in 1598. And my family has been there. That has been our home, you might say, since 1598. I came to this understanding of crypto-Judaism and this story was actually in the 1980s, a fellow pastor who was originally from Ecuador. He was pastoring in northern New Mexico where I had pastored earlier. And he mentioned to me, he says, Arnold, I think, yo creo que tú eres una sefardita. I think that you're a Sephardic Jew. I said, what? What is that? Well, that was the first time that I came to understand something about the Sephardic Jewish experience. As I began to do more reading, I'd been doing some research into my genealogy and had a lot of names, had like 500 names and traced my ancestry back to the 1500s to Spain. And so I had a lot of names, but I really did not know very much about them. And later on, wanting to learn more and more, I began to notice some articles that came out in the popular press, the Albuquerque papers, and some magazines that were talking about crypto Jews of New Mexico and Colorado. And I thought, whoa, well, that is interesting. And I began to notice some names associated with the research that was being done. And one name particularly was paramount, a fellow by the name of Stanley Hortys, who had been the historian for the state of New Mexico. And I kept following his name, trying to get more information and all. And he was writing a book at that time, because this was in the 1990s or so. And in 2005, his book was published by Columbia University Press, entitled To the End of the Earth, A History of the Crypto Jews of New Mexico. Wow, I was so excited to learn about this work and to read it. And I wrote a review of it for Amazon. And I began to notice some names that he kept referring to, because in this, in his book, he traces families from New Mexico using primary resources, original sources from the Inquisition records, from church records, etc., and began to notice a number of names. And so I started comparing the names that Dr. Hortys was mentioning, and was comparing. I compared it to the family tree names, and I found a number of names that were the same family. They were the same people. I thought, wow, this is amazing. I then, because of my interest in, you know, the Jewish roots now, I also did a DNA test. I went on a website for Sephardic Jews, and I found there a family tree DNA that they would take your DNA. And so I ordered the kit and sent it in and got the results back. And sure enough, the haplogroups, the DNA studies, are the same as people who are Jews. And
now,
so
can I ask you something really quick? I don't mean to interrupt you, Arnold. So what is that haplogroup? Do you know what that
J2.
Actual, what is it?
J2.
J2, okay. Okay, thank
right.
you.
That was the J's and J2's are the haplogroups that are most associated with Jewish people.
Okay. Are there any other haplogroups that are associated with them, or is that primarily, or do you know?
That is primarily.
Uh-huh.
I'm not an expert in that field, but I have done the tests, and, you know, those are the results. I wanted to test the test, right, because I kind of dubious about things. So I asked my son if he would do it, and of course it's an exact match for him, as you would expect. Now, there are different kinds of DNA, this Y chromosome, the father, you know, my father's 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 father, you know, on back. And it's interesting, some cousins who come out exactly the same, again, they turned out that, right, well, we have the same DNA thing, and so...
Wow, that's amazing. I need to interrupt you, though, really quickly, because we're getting a lot of feedback on your phone. I'm hoping that you're not on a speakerphone, I hope you're not close to any computer or anything like that. So I just want to make sure that we're very clear when we're speaking or when you're speaking, because we were getting a lot of talk back. So, and that you know, takes away from your presentation. But that's interesting that you found that out. And now you're actually, you're a vice president of the Pacific Union Conference of the Seventh-day Adventists. And you're still, you know, I have an aunt and uncle that were Adventists, so they still, there's still a lot of Old Testament practices or beliefs in there. Am I correct or am I not correct?
The Seventh-day Adventist Church takes as authoritative both the New Testament as well as the Old Testament,
right?
And so. Some of the things that are very similar to Jewish practices include dietary restrictions in regards to clean and unclean foods, the authority resting, the keeping of the seventh-day Sabbath, Saturday, from sundown Friday to sundown Saturday, and the authority of the... number of different things that Jews practice today are very similar in terms of what Adventists practice today. It's a Christian denomination that is very Bible-based, however very Christ-centered and very grace-oriented, even though we believe that the teaching of Scripture is that we should continue to observe the Sabbath that was instituted in the Garden of Eden before there were any Jews.
but of course reinforced by Moses and the Decalogue at Sinai.
Mm-hmm. So I know that there's a lot of people that could look into their background and find that they do have elements of some Jewish heritage. Where it becomes kind of a gray area, and I am going to talk to Dolores about this more in depth in a little bit, but where it becomes a little bit of a gray area and where people need to just kind of tread lightly, I think, this is just my opinion, though, is when you have surnames that are Spanish and they're listed as Sephardic names, a lot of times people see that and go, oh, my gosh, my last name is Munoz, or my last name is Cortez, or my last name is this or that, and they're Spanish surnames, they immediately think that they're Jewish in ancestry. So a lot of, like even Rachel was talking earlier, her last name is Amado, or her maiden name was Amado. A lot of Sephardic Jews, Spanish Jews, have Spanish last names. So no different than, any other Spanish person. So anyway, but that's something that me and Dolores will continue on. But I'm glad that you were able to find this out in your background. How exciting is that? And then I'm sure you're helping other people that have a similar background in discovering this this past, or maybe guiding them, right?
In my particular instance, I believe that there are a number of customs that our family practiced over the centuries and years, but I believe in my particular case, my ancestors were, some of them, there's no doubt, were crypto Jews. Others, I believe, were sincere conversos. And so they were able to assimilate into the dominant culture and religion. Yet they continued to practice some things, but they didn't really know that they had a Jewish origin. But they continued to practice them because it was a part of the northern New Mexico or southern Colorado culture. And language as well. Interestingly, Rachel was talking about Ladino, and the language of the Spanish language of northern New Mexico and southern Colorado has, among in some circles, has been identified as Ladino-like, and they attribute it to Jewish influence. The crypto-Jewish influence, the Spanish-Jewish influence from Spain.
Interesting. Now, so your family has been in Colorado and New Mexico since the 1500s?
1598. Some of my ancestors came with Oñate. And Oñate, he colonized colony there in what is now northern New Mexico near Española, and he brought with him about 400 people and about 130 families and settled there, and some of my ancestors were those that came with him. Others came afterwards on the Quintana side, for example. Those ancestors came in the 1690s as part of the resettling of northern New Mexico.
So, because I'm not very knowledgeable on this subject, I know in Mexico, there are groups of Jews there, too, that their families have moved over to the southwest part of the United States. Now, what would be the difference between, say, them and, say, the type, where your family, or is there a mixture, or, so help me out, because it's kind of confusing, becomes convoluted to me.
Well, the San Luis Valley in southern Colorado and the families at northern New Mexico, they are all
a part of the same group, the same families, you might say. That was the northernmost frontier of New Spain, which was the viceroyalty of New Spain. That was the northernmost frontier. That was as far as the Spanish Empire in the Americas reached.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In Mexico, for example, you have the story of the Nuevo León, which was a province of northern New Mexico, the capital of which was Monterrey. That is a colony that was colonized, that was a colony that was established by a fellow by the name of Luis Carvajal. Luis Carvajal was a Jew. I mean, he was a converso. He was really not so much a crypto Jew. And when he got the authority to colonize there, he was given permission to bring his families from Spain and a number of his relatives from Spain. Among his relatives were a nephew, a fellow by the same name, Luis Carvajal the Younger, and he became a very ardent Jew. And he began to proselyte among his family as well as others. And, of course, the Inquisition got wind and arrested him. And in 1596, a couple of years before the colonization effort, he and his mother and two sisters were burned at the stake in Mexico City. The governor, because of his relationship, of course, with his family and all, was arrested, taken to Mexico City, ended up dying in the Inquisition prison there. So the influence of the Jewish crypto-Judaism and the conversos exists, especially in the province of Nuevo León, Monterrey, and they, as well as in other places along the Rio Grande Valley, you had the movement was north trying to get out of the oversight of the inquisitors, who were looking for people who were continuing to practice, who had backslidden, as they said, into Judaism. But not all conversos were crypto Jews. Some were, and many were not. But they continued to practice things that, such as Rachel has been pointing out, and as Jeannie pointed out, they continued to practice things, to have customs that had their roots in Judaism, but that, because of the passage of time and all, many lost the connection between what they were doing and Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
But some
mm-hmm.
held on to it.
Mm. Interesting. Very interesting. Well, it's been a pleasure speaking to you and hearing about your past. Now, if anybody wants to get in touch with you, do you have a way that people can get a hold of you?
Sure.
Do you have a way? Okay.
Yeah.
And that would be?
You could just Arnold, T-R-U-J, first four letters of my last name, ArnoldTRUJ@gmail.com.
Okay. Well, Arnold, it's been a pleasure. Was there anything else that you wanted to close this up with, or do you think that pretty much encapsulated everything that you really wanted to share?
The thing that, for me, that has been most fascinating about this
mm-hmm.
whole subject
mm-hmm.
has been the amazing reality
mm-hmm.
that people were able to transmit a commitment to values and beliefs and practices
mm-hmm.
century after century
mm-hmm.
in a most hostile kind of an environment.
Mm-hmm.
It's a testimony to me of the perseverance of faith.
Mm-hmm.
In spite
mm-hmm.
of amazing persecution and challenges,
mm-hmm.
that part of this story
is something that I would like to do continuing research on. How is it that faith is able to be transmitted in such adverse circumstances?
That's great. Yeah, I mean, I've learned so much. I mean, having we've already done two programs. We have another one coming up, and then we're doing this one this evening. And then, of course, I've had friends that are Jews, and I had an uncle on my paternal side that he converted over to be a Jew. And, you know, I have a lot of background. My father's mother in New York City was during a really bad time in her life, was really held up in a good way, meaning they looked up, they looked after her, this whole group of Jewish people looked after her. They were living in a borough of New York City for her and her children. So, you know, so I have very warm and loving memories of that and that culture. But, you know, really, quite honestly, the thing that surprised me most this evening, well, there's two things. And number one is that there are people that are that descend from the Sephardic Jew that are Christians, you know. That's number one, and are practicing Christians. That's number one. And they're still Jewish by their ancestry, by their heritage, by their culture.
Mm-hmm.
And number two is when Jeannie was talking about that group in – now, this was the most bizarre thing because I've never, ever heard of anything like this – in Portugal that merges Roman Catholicism with Judaism, and then they pray to St. Moses and St. Esther and all this kind of stuff. That, to me, was the most bizarre thing. I've never heard of anything like that. So those are two things that really stood out, and I'm glad that they did, because it's caused me – it's caused me to broaden my education level. Obviously, I have a broader understanding now of things that I did not know of, and as I'm sure many people that hear this program will feel the same way. So, anyway,
one of the things, Joey, if I could just interject, one of the byproducts of this journey that I've been on is a most profound appreciation for Judaism that I didn't have before. I knew about biblical Judaism, you know, the story of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
But post-biblical Judaism, I really did not know the story very much until I started making these discoveries. And it just really awakened in me an interest in, you know, what is it that, what was being practiced, for instance, by the Jews in Spain in the 15th century, you know, and all. And then how was this practiced, you know, in a hidden way carried on? But a most profound respect for Judaism and the Jewish people, but also because of the fact that, as I think Dolly mentioned, that the Islamic Al-Andalus was the name of the place that they gave, you know, for the Moors, Al-Andalus, and that during the period of time when the Moors were the dominant force in Spain, in medieval Spain. It's been called the ornament of the world by an author, but the benevolent governance, if you please, by the Moors of the Jews and the Christians during that time, a period of coexistence, of not necessarily total peaceful coexistence, but certainly they developed a culture of tolerance. And I thought to myself, wow, is there not something here that we can learn today where these three major religions, three monotheistic religions, were able to live in harmony and coexistence, and that their culture among the Muslims, among the Christians, among the Jews was a flowering of culture, of education, of language, etc. And I thought to myself, wow, we need to learn some things today about what they had going for them there in those centuries there in the 900s, 1000, you know, back in the Middle Ages there in Spain. So I've
to
learned
your
a lot
point,
about Islam. Mm-hmm. I've learned a lot about Islam and about Judaism that I've come to really appreciate much more now than I ever did before I started this journey.
Oh, well, that's great. That's a really important. I think, you know, situations like this cause us to really be able to understand each other in a better light. So anyway, I thank you so much, Arnold, for joining us, and I'll look forward to speaking to you in the future. So thanks again for being with us. Okay, thank you. And so, again, that was Arnold Trujillo. In our next segment here, this gentleman has been waiting a long, long time, and my hat really goes off to him, and, you know, in appreciation of just his patience. Matthew Wachowski is the Associate Professor of Spanish at the University of Portland, Vice President of Programs for the Society for Crypto-Judaic Studies. He is presently completing a book manuscript about Iberian crypto-Jews in colonial Hispanic America. And without further ado, he will be talking about the manifestation of Latin America, Western Europe, Netherlands, and Great Britain, past and present. So, Matthew, thank you very much for your patience. How are you?
Okay, Joey, I'm fine. Thank you for inviting me to be on the show. And I've been listening, and I don't know what I can add. People have said so much, so many, you know, wonderful and important information. But I'll certainly do my best.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Well, so you're going to be covering an area of you're going to be covering an area that we didn't really cover that much of, that will encompass also Western Europe, Netherlands, and Great Britain, right?
That's right. I'll talk a little bit about that, and then I can talk about the in a little more detail the crypto Jews in the 1600s in Mexico and Peru, just a little bit after the Carvajal family that Arnold just mentioned.
Okay, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Joey. I just wanted to add to what Jeannie talked about, how crypto-Judaism took a special root in Portugal, more so than in Spain. And this was really because after the forced conversions of the Jews in 1497 there, the forced baptism, the king of Portugal, Manuel, basically left the conversos alone. He said, okay, I'm not going to investigate your Catholicism. And this went on for about 40 years. An Inquisition tribunal was not established in Portugal until 1536, which is basically two generations. And so a lot of people think, aha, that helps explain why crypto-Judaism had a much stronger root in Portugal than in Spain, and why so many of the crypto-Jews who then left Portugal were of Portuguese origin. And in fact, in the 1600s, to call someone Portuguese was basically to call someone Portuguese not in Portugal was to say that person is a new Christian. And in the eyes of a lot of people, new Christian meant Jew, which, you know, as Arnold just said, wasn't always true. A lot of conversos were not, and, you know, were not automatically Jewish just by de facto. But what happened is that a lot of the converso families stuck together, and they became involved in trade, and they established roots, not just in Portugal, but as Rachel was mentioning, some of them went to the Eastern Mediterranean, to what's Salonika, Istanbul. Others went to Amsterdam, Hamburg, London. And then, of course, quite a few crossed the Atlantic to Brazil. Some people say that up to 10% of Brazilians today are descendants, or have Jewish ancestry. That, of course, doesn't mean that they're practicing Jews at all, but so a large number of the conversos went to Brazil. And then, just bear with me with the history here, between 1580 and 1640, Spain basically annexed Portugal. And so it made that annexation made it possible for a lot of the Portuguese who were living in Portugal to actually, a lot of these conversos, to return to Spain, not necessarily in order to be secret Jews, but because at that time, the 1600s, Spain was one of the great mercantile empires of the world. Sevilla was, probably the most important port city in Europe, and a lot of people who wanted to make their fortune, wanted to make it big, went to Seville with the hope of then traveling in a flotilla to the Americas. But let me just quick mention the Netherlands or Holland at that time. You know, Holland, there was the Catholic part, which is, I'm kind of generalizing, but I mean, by and large, the Catholic part, which is today Belgium, and then the Protestant part, which was the United Provinces of the Netherlands that included the great city of Amsterdam. And the rulers there provided a welcome to the conversos, and basically said it's sort of a live and let live policy. They allowed for the establishment of a synagogue there, and so many conversos traveled to Amsterdam, and they weren't really Jews at this point. They maybe had been Jews previously before their conversion, or their ancestors had been Jews, but in Amsterdam they could become fully fledged, so to speak, practicing Jews. And there's the beautiful synagogue there that I believe was built in the 1600s. It's the Esnoga, it's called, the Spanish and Portuguese synagogue. Excuse me, it was not destroyed during the Second World War, so you can still visit it today. And in the 1600s, there was a community of Jews, almost all Sephardic Jews, so Iberian Jews, and really Portuguese within Iberia, in Amsterdam, 2,000 people, which at that time was one of the largest openly practicing Jewish communities in Europe. Now, the Netherlands, or Holland, at that time was also a great mercantile power, and so there were numerous opportunities for the Jews there to become involved in the exploration of the Dutch West India Company to the Americas, and I believe to a lesser extent with the Dutch East India Company that was expanding to what are today the islands of Indonesia. And the Dutch West India Company was, from a very pragmatic, sort of practical point of view, interested in the participation of the Jews because of their familial connections. The Sephardim were much better placed than a lot of Catholic families because they had the Sephardim ended up having relatives, in some cases, on three or four different continents. Mm-hmm. Which facilitated their success as merchants of all kinds of commodities, and you know, and I'm talking even of slaves here, unfortunately. But also sugar and silver. You know, Brazil in the 1600s was, I believe, the world's largest producer of sugar that had originally had been come from China, and then the Moors brought it the Middle East, and then the Portuguese brought it to the Madeira Islands in the Atlantic, and from there the cane was carried to the São Tomé and Príncipe, some islands in the Atlantic near the coast of Cameroon, and then further across the Atlantic all the way to Brazil. And then the Spaniards started mining silver in Potosí, today in Bolivia, but the conversos were participated in this trade as some of them, of course, came to the New World or to the Americas to try and live as crypto Jews, and some certainly did. But a large number, I would say, a large number, maybe more, really came for mercantile reasons. There were simply more opportunities for them in the Americas. Now, I'm kind of jumping around here, but I'm just pretending to be a Sephardic family with links all over the world. We have to mention England as well. The Jews had been thrown out of England, I believe, in don't quote me here, 1290. They had been expelled from England for about 350 years until the 1650s, when Manasseh, and I'm blanking on his first name, but Manasseh ben Israel, who was a Portuguese. He was a Portuguese origin who had gone to Amsterdam and had become an openly practicing Jew there. He negotiated the return of the Jews to England for the first time in 350 years, Mm-hmm. And that took place in the mid-1600s. And a lot of those original families who resettled England, like Moses Montefiore and others, were actually Sephardic families. They were of mostly Portuguese origin, and then before the Portuguese, Spanish origin, and coming through Amsterdam, and then also Hamburg. So
now,
that is a go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No. I've been talking rather quickly, I think.
Well, now, so I'm wondering, did those people also retain a Spanish type of language, or did they lose it? Do you know?
You know, that's a good question. I do believe that they retained, actually, this is interesting, the Spanish language, not the Ladino language, but the and that's an important distinction, because in Amsterdam were a lot of intellectuals who had come from Spain, kind of following the route that Rachel mentioned through with her ancestors on her, I think her mom's side, possibly being from Bayonne in southern France. A lot of the conversos in Amsterdam actually traveled from Spain through France sometimes through Portugal, sometimes not, to Amsterdam, and these were people who were very literary people and who were scholars and who wanted to remain in contact with the kind of the literary trends of Spain. I mean, at that time, this time of Spain's great literary golden age, the time of Cervantes and the Golden Age Theater of Lope de Vega and his friends. So, a lot of the writing that was produced by Jews, open Jews or conversos or former Jews or new Jews in Amsterdam is actually in the Castilian Spanish of the 1600 Spain. Now, I don't know if they used it in their everyday kind of lingua franca, but certainly as a means of literary expression, poetic expression, the language, the Castilian language was used in Amsterdam in the 1600s.
So again, the time frame that these Jews were in Amsterdam and England, we're talking 1600s, basically?
Yeah, we're talking 1600s, and then...
Okay,
go
ahead.
No, I was just going to 1600s, and then these families, you know, some of them, like the family that Rachel mentioned of Doña Gracia Mendez, some of them traveled from Antwerp or Amsterdam then to Italy and then on to the Eastern Mediterranean to the Ottoman Empire. But, you know, a number of the families stayed in Amsterdam maybe at some point they intermarried with Ashkenazic families there, but you can see names of the very sort of Portuguese-sounding names on the deportation lists in the 1940s when the Nazis had invaded Netherlands. So, you know, this sort of genealogy or line of Jewish people remained in Amsterdam. I don't know with what degree of connection to their Sephardic past, but certainly there must have been some for hundreds of years.
Yeah, you know what's interesting to me, and I don't want to get off on another topic, and we've got to close it up, wrap it up pretty quick here.
Sure.
But what's
sure.
interesting to me is the fact that you've heard of the Spanish Netherlands, right?
Yes.
And I believe that Spain controlled the Netherlands from 1580 something. To like the early 1700s, if I'm not mistaken. So
I'm not quite sure of the dates, but
yeah,
that's right.
That's kind of interesting because if they did indeed control it during that time, and this is when the Jews were going over there, it's just interesting that it would be open if it was so controlled by. You know what I'm saying? If it was controlled so much by.
And my understanding, and this is not my field of research, but my understanding is they controlled kind of what's the more Catholic part of, in other words, the southern Netherlands. I mean, what today we would is Belgium. I don't know how strong I don't know that they, I don't believe they controlled the area around Amsterdam or in The Hague or Delft, but more their sphere of influence was, you know, on the more Catholic side of that territory, which,
okay,
you know, is Belgium. That's, I mean, that's what I would say to that. I mean, you raise a very good point, and I guess that's what I would, that would be my comment.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's been, it's really, is there any other, is there anything else that you'd like to interject here before I try to close this program up? Is there anything that we're leaving out that you want to make sure that you get in before
we... we'll take a second, a minute, no more, I promise. Interrupt me whenever you want. We'll go across the ocean to Lima and to Mexico City, where in about a 15-year period between 1635 and 1649, the Inquisition tribunals in those two capitals, they were capitals of the Spanish viceroyalties, prosecuted very large numbers of mostly Portuguese new Christians as heretics, as secret Jews. And the reason, certainly religion played a part. I mean, as... I can't remember, one of the earlier speakers tonight saying that the Inquisition, I think it was Dolly mentioning how the Inquisition prosecuted conversos for their practice of what, quote-unquote, the dead law of Moses. But really, continuous with that, there's a lot of evidence, very clear evidence, that the prosecution had a lot to do with political reasons and with economic reasons. And the political part is really interesting. As I mentioned, Portugal had been annexed by Spain at this time, and the Spaniards were very fearful that the Portuguese new Christians, remember these are Portuguese people in Spanish territories, were somehow in cahoots with the Portuguese-controlled Brazil and with Portugal itself, kind of as a way to subvert Spanish imperial or hegemony of their Hispanic viceroyalties of Mexico and Peru. So the prosecution for ostensible religious reasons also, I think, addressed political and then economic concerns. Certainly not all, but a small minority of the conversos were very wealthy. Again, I want to emphasize a small minority, but some of them were very wealthy, and they had achieved that wealth. As I mentioned earlier, some through the trade in African slaves, others kind of trading with... all throughout the Americas, but also then with the Spanish territories in the Philippines. So it's kind of like worldwide trade empires. So anyway, it's always important to talk about those great prosecutions, because after that, whoever survived, the survivors of those prosecutions in the 16, we're now in the mid-1600s, those are the ones, I think, who really became... in large part, the origin, one of the contributors to the crypto Jews whom we see today, or many people today, are descendants of the survivors of those prosecutions of crypto Jews by the Spanish Inquisition, you know, almost 400 years ago now.
Well, I thank you so much for that's perfect, and that's a great way to wrap it up. I also wanted to mention, I know if people are interested in finding out more about any conferences that the Society of Crypto Judaic, what is it?
Studies.
Help me out here.
Crypto Judaic Studies. Society of Crypto Judaic Studies.
Right, and its conferences and activities. They can go to the website, which is cryptojews.com. Very easy.
That's
CRYPTOJews.com. Is that correct?
That's correct. All one word. You know,
all one word.
They can go there, and we have a yearly conference, and they can read all about it.
All right. Well, Matthew, and people can get in touch with you through that as well.
Yes, they can email me. It's the first eight letters of my last name, Warshaws, Warshaws. @up.edu.
Okay, great. Well, so thank you so much for joining us this evening, and we hope to hear from you from the future, all right?
Thank you, Joey. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. We have too.
All right.
And that was Matthew, again, speaking to us. And now we're going to wrap this up. I'm going to bring Dolores on. Dolores, this was a really fun and exciting and interesting program. We've got a lot of information, some stuff that I did not know about. We've only got a few minutes to wrap this up, but I did want to ask you something that's been on my mind. Perhaps you can give me clarity, okay?
Yes.
So here's my thought. My thought is there are certain surnames that are very much associated with Judaism and or Jewish people. Like the last name Levy or Levy or however you say it, L-E-V-Y, Cohen, certain names that we know. But then there's also names that are very Spanish, either Spanish-sounding or they're identical to Spanish surnames. So I think people need to be cognizant of the fact just because, and so two of my questions are, just because somebody has a name that is a Spanish surname does not denote that they are of Jewish heritage. Also, I don't know if you know anything about the haplogroups I'm trying to think who I was speaking to in the program about this. But they had mentioned, I believe it was J2 haplogroup, is primarily associated with
I think it was R.
Okay, right, with the Jews. So maybe you can touch on both things. If you know about anything more on the haplogroups, that's fine. If not, we'll get that when we do a DNA program on here as well. So, anyway, those are my two closing. We've got about 5 minutes to wrap this up, and so if you could address those, that would be great.
Okay, well, I'll deal with the haplogroups first because that's the subject I know the least about. I would refer people to Family Tree DNA. It's just what it sounds like, FamilyTreeDNA.com. It may be .org, but if you Google it, you'll get it's a very reputable genealogical studies company.
Right.
And once
we may be doing something with them in the future. Yeah, so that's fine.
Well,
once
you do your DNA, they then explain to you what group you're in and what it means so that it's all clarified. I wish I could really enlighten you more about that, but it's some area that I have to learn a lot about too.
No, that's okay.
Now,
well, thank you.
Move to the names. There are Jews up until a certain period, and I can't give you an exact date, but I would say it would be probably around the 15th century. It really didn't have a name, a surname. A person was known as the son or daughter of the father. So someone would be, for example, I would be Dolores Bat Pincus, and Pincus would be my father's name, and Bat means daughter of. So people were named, and the males would be son of or Ben something. Then in the 15th century, different governments began to require that everybody have a surname, and this included Christians and other groups that were very informal about surnames. So everybody had to take a surname, and very often Jews probably took common names of Spaniards because that would make their life safer,
right,
if they had a Spanish surname. Also, you'll find, just like I said, daughter of or son of, you'll have a name, for example, like Hernandez, where E-S or E-Z means son of or daughter of Hernan. So Hernandez means son of Hernan. or of Hernan, really. It means of Hernan. So any name ending in E-S or E-Z means of that particular patriarch, meaning a child of that particular patriarch. And then we have the time of all the conversions. And when that happened, Jews had to take a Christian name, or they had to get rid of their Jewish name. So they often took the name of the baptizing clergyman. So, for example, the great Santangel family, S-A-N-T-A-N-G-E-L, Santangel family of Valencia, Spain, took the name of the presiding bishop who converted the first convert of the family. And you have that throughout. People took those names. And so I think that's pretty much it. So when you see the name Garcia, for example, some of the people will be Christian and some of them will be Jewish. And you can't tell by the name who's who. Now, there are certain names like Rael, R-A-E-L. Rael is a shortening of Israel. Yes. So that name we know is a Sephardic name. And
yeah, or, right, or if you see the
name.
There
are names like, names like Benveniste or Halfon, which were names that existed for centuries, and there are still survivors. In fact, the treasurer of our organization is a Benveniste. And so that's about it. You cannot tell by a name what the person's religious history was.
Yeah. And I think that's really important, because I think some people get misinformation, or I've got to wrap up the show in 2 minutes, but basically they get, and I thank you so much for explaining that. I know somebody that was like really excited, and they were like, oh, I think I'm Jewish. You know, I said, why is that? And they said, because my last name, and they came up with this last name that was a standard Spanish name, Castilian Spanish, I said, I don't think you can just go by that. I think, no, that's supposed to be, and I said, I don't think so. I said, you really need to look into that, because I don't think that you can just say this surname, unless it's like the ones that you had mentioned, or something like Levy, L-E-V-Y. I mean, right there, you would know. Because it's something biblical, right there you would know that this would be, or the other one that you were talking about, which was a shortened one for Israel, certain ones that you would know right off the top. So thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Just one more little thing, and that is sometimes in a region like Arnold was talking about, a region like northern New Mexico, southern Colorado, where you have an awful lot of people who have the same names again and again that don't appear much in other regions, then you almost, if you trace back the history, you'll almost always find that those names are Sephardic. But that's because of that region and because of the peculiar knowledge we have of the fact that it was settled heavily by conversos.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Dolores. I think it was a great and informative show. And if people want to get in touch with you, they can reach you at www.doloressloan.com, DoloresSloan.com. Also, by the same, under crypto, CRYPTO, Jews.com. And again, it was a wonderful program. I think it was informative. Again, there were things that we discussed tonight that we did not discuss on the other two shows. So I think it will be enlightening for those that listen. I think it will be very informative. And as we progress down the road, we're going to be doing a DNA show, probably maybe one with Family Tree DNA, one with another, and people will have a better understanding. They'll be able to put one and one together. They'll be able to read your book, which, again, is The Sephardic Jews of Spain and Portugal. They'll be able to read Jeannie Milgram's book on her 15, My 15 Grandmothers, is that right?
Yeah, My 15
and,
Grandmothers.
Yeah, and be able to piece everything together and really get some information, important information, and then doing like, like Arnold had mentioned, doing a tree, having your genealogy checked through DNA is really important too. And you piece it all together, and you come up, you start weaving your past together, and you're able to get all this great stuff that comes together. So again, I thank you so much for joining us tonight on this program on Crypto Jews, and I look forward to speaking to you again really soon, Dolores.
And I too, yes.
Okay, thank you so much. And folks, again, be sure that this show will be in the archives, so you can make sure that you're able to tell your family and friends about it. Very interesting, a lot of interesting information, stuff that we covered tonight that has not been covered before. So definitely make sure that you're able to share this with your friends and your family members, et cetera. So as always, I look forward to our next show. Make sure you stay in tune and look at our show page, and it'll tell you about some upcoming programs. I think one that would go really well with this is when we do the one on DNA. That's going to be, an important program to link your past together, to connect the dots, so to speak. So, and then we will be also doing another show on Sephardic Jews as well, and the Spanish Jews of of North Africa, so the ones that speak Akkadia. So anyway, again, thank you so much for joining us on Live from the Bay with Joey. And until the next time, take care and have a great one. Bye-bye now.